Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 9th of November and this is episode 85. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Tom Switzer, the Executive Director of the Centre for Independent Studies over in Sydney. Really good chat about the US midterms and his reflections on Dan Hannan's tour. He gave the John Bonython lecture. That's how it's pronounced, the John Bonython lecture in Sydney last week. So we'll get his reflections on Dan Hannan's tour and identity politics as well.
Be interesting to see how that goes because I wasn't there for that.
Yeah, so the keen-eyed listener, the keen-eared listener might be able to distinguish that Peter Gregory is not there due to illness. And so I man the fort, my own little Joe Rogan thing going on, just like this free-form interview. So hopefully you guys all enjoyed that. We're later than going to be
4 hours.
Oh, yeah. And I was... No, I can't say that. You'll never know where that was going, but I'm assuming any one of you Joe Rogan fans will be able to have guessed. But anyway, after that, we're going to be talking to Simon Breeny, the outgoing policy director here at the IPA. We're going to be giving him an exit interview.
We should have done that, actually.
Yeah. You know. Well, that's basically what it was. We did straight up ask him if he's going to miss more out of you or me, which I've never had an exit interview here. I imagine that's what happens.
That's true. We didn't ask him for the negatives, though. You know, what are you happy that you're leaving?
Kind of thing. There's no negatives here, Pete.
Well, that's good because we didn't ask him.
Okay, good. All right. So that's all coming up in the show, but let's talk some the main topics. And I think the big topic this week was the US midterm elections. Yeah. The most important elections of our lifetime.
Of anyone, yeah.
Of anyone ever. Yeah. As I was constantly reminded on Twitter in the weeks before. Well, I got told to vote by more celebrities than I knew existed.
Well, I got told to vote by people I know, so.
How did you vote at the US midterm? Well, you're struggled. In a swing state.
I struggled.
Brunswick is a swing state in the US midterm election.
I was just glad to not, well, no, it's not, but I was just glad to not have to vote.
Yeah.
You know, like in a, that have the right not to vote that we don't have in Australia. So I took that.
Well, yeah, so I'm for voluntary voting. I would vote anyway, but yeah.
Yep.
The whole thing of like, you need to go vote. And that's the other thing is like celebrities going, go vote, go vote, go vote. It's, you know, cut it out. Like, we know what you're saying.
Yeah.
They're not telling Republicans to go do that.
That's right. I mean, well, are we going to do the celebrities now?
We'll get into it. We'll get into it later. So let's get some facts out of the way.
Yeah, well.
Bring some structure and some integrity to what we're talking about. So, midterm elections, it's, you know, somewhat of a referendum on how people are seeing Trump's first term.
Always, yeah.
There was the idea that it was going to be a big blue wave. The Democrats are going to take a lot back. They did take back the House. They gained 28 seats, and they've now got a majority in the House. But surprisingly, the Republicans extended their lead over the Senate, picking up 3 new seats.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think what we linked to in Hayes sort of called it a purple wave. Basically,
Purple puddle.
So basically, no one really quite knows what to make of it. So a stat here for you. Clinton lost 52 Democratic seats in the House in his first midterm. Obama lost 63 Democrat seats in the House in his first term. And Trump lost 28. So everyone cops it, seems to be the idea.
My influence has really rubbed off on you.
Yeah, I've really become Pete, which is terrifying sense. Everyone's got like every first term president cops it. I think George Bush also lost a fair few as well. But Trump doesn't seem to have copped it as much as others have. So the thing is, I switched over to CNN coverage and there seemed to be a lot of, you know, Democrats and Republicans going, we won, no, we won, no, we won, no, we won.
Yeah.
I mean, Fox News had like, you know, the stats and analysis and I wanted people yelling at each other. So I switched it over to CNN and I was not left wanting.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that you got what you wanted.
And they're both right is my point. It's like both sides can walk away going like, the Democrats can walk away going like, hey, we took back the House, you know, at something. And then the Republicans will be like, holy moly, we extended our lead over the Senate. So
yeah, a bit of a draw. And that Senate thing's not insignificant because obviously in the USA, they don't have the same party discipline. So having a bigger majority helps.
Yes, absolutely.
Which you don't really need in Australia as much.
So one thing, and we talk about this with Tom Switzer later in the show, one thing that really sort of was hanging over this was the Kavanaugh nominations. I thought it was interesting. 4 of the big 5 vulnerable Senate Democrats, so the Senate being obviously the more surprising one, 4 of the big 5 vulnerable Senate Democrats lost tonight. So you had Donnelly, Hardcamp, McCaskill, Nelson, all 4 voted against Kavanaugh. They were out. The Democratic senators were out. The one that did vote for Kavanaugh, Joe Manchin, prevails. So we talked about it with Morgan before how contentious that debate was. It's interesting to see that a lot of voters really took umbrage with people voting against Kavanaugh.
So they were Democrats in states that voted for Trump.
Mm,
is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, that was interesting. But the big loser We talk about everyone having a draw. The big loser, as we've alluded to, is US celebrities.
Yes.
Tough day.
Well, you know.
Tough
day. They deserve it.
Yeah. So we had Taylor Swift, who came out of the woodwork, never commented on politics before, finally threw herself behind a candidate, endorsed former Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen, a Democrat for the Senate. He lost. Rihanna endorsed Democrat Andrew Gillum, who was a pretty far-left guy for Florida. He's out. Sean Diddy Combs, P. Diddy, Puff Daddy, whatever you want to call him. He endorsed Stacey Abrams for Georgia governorship. She's out. Beyonce, as well as pretty much every celebrity on the planet, endorsed Beto O'Rourke down in Texas, and he lost. So tough day for celebrities.
So just to clarify, Taylor Swift, Oprah, P. Diddy, Rihanna, and Beyonce all backed losing candidates.
Yes.
Can I ask, why was that one in Texas such a big deal?
Well, because he's really charming, and he's young, and...
Near the border? Is that...
So, no, he's born in El Paso, which I think
is... No, I meant Texas.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, well, and then people just got into the groundswell because, like, he's really charming. He's up against Ted Cruz, who is not charming. And basically the idea, if you can knock Ted Cruz out of Texas, that's a huge deal. Yeah. Like, we talk about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez knocking out, what's his name? Garland?
Because she won, didn't she?
Well, yeah. I mean, like, any Democrat that ran was going to win.
Okay, yeah.
But her big win was in the primaries when she knocked out, like, a big-time Democrat. Yeah. So that would have been the same thing for the Republicans. Like, holy moly, we turned Texas blue, and there's no more Ted Cruz.
Okay, but alas, no biscuit.
No biscuit yet. I reckon, yeah, I think, so Switzer says we don't know, and we don't know.
Oh, okay.
This really does set him up for Beto O'Rourke 2020. Is what I'm saying. That's it's not exactly a James Bond breaking prediction. Everyone in the world saying it, but I want it on record right now. Beto O'Rourke will be the Democratic nominee for 2020.
Well, I haven't heard that, James. So to me, you are a newsbreaker. Can I hit you with a couple of stats?
Go.
Turnout was meant though obviously this was sold out, this election where the young people came out and had their voices heard. Still only 31% of people between the ages of 18 and 29 turned out, which to be fair is 10 percentage points higher than 2014. Overall turnout was 47%. In 2014, that was only 36.7%. And it was the highest midterm turnout since 1966.
So maybe it was the most important election of all time.
Well, it was the...
The fifth lead in the latest Elder Scrolls film was right.
Yes. Basically. I just got that to me. I want to get through it. But yeah. That's my facts, which I know Nana likes.
All right. I want to talk about another element of this because, and this specifically applies to the Beto O'Rourke campaign. There seemed that what I found really interesting was this idea, like, you know, they're pointing fingers at each other, like, how did Beto lose? And a lot of it's come down to white women. Like, there's a lot of hatred towards white women.
Aren't they just the worst? Left.
So Jemele Hill, former ESPN anchor, now writing for The Atlantic. This is like, there was a lot of tweets like this. I think DeRay also got involved and a lot of other people. But Jemele Hill, I'll just take this one. So 59% of white women voted for Ted Cruz. 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. So given these numbers, who is the real face of feminism? I reckon Jemele Hill is because as all good feminists do, she says that entire blocks of women should vote as one unthinking block.
Yeah.
Which is feminism.
It's
is that feminism?
Well, look, it's...
Hang on, what's feminism? If it's not everyone voting the same way and not thinking for themselves, then what's feminism?
Well, I mean, there's obviously a dispute over what feminism is.
Yep.
I have my own views about that. But this is just one of the files, one for the files of there's no one more sexist to women in the world at the moment than modern feminism. Well, I mean, there are, but... I stuff that point up. You know what I'm
saying? Yeah, there's at least two. Yeah. But yeah,
modern feminists are always sexist.
Yeah, just the idea that, like...
To women, not to men.
Yeah, but it's, you know, sort of the effects of, like, cultural Marxism or whatever it is, but it's like, oh, there are blocks of people, and you are not an individual, you're just part of your, you know, gender or ethnic makeup, and therefore you will vote in the way that we tell you to.
If you fancy your life with a little bit less regulation, you're not a real woman.
Mm.
James.
Mm.
Anyway, no, I agree.
All right.
But for once, we agree on something.
But not for long, so tune in later in the show. We're going to be experimenting with a debate.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk about... what do we want? We've got nuclear energy and we've got the no growth movement.
Let's talk about nuclear energy because if you really cared about women, you'd support nuclear energy. That's not even a joke. Okay. That's just true.
Or if you cared about anyone, really.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
expand
yeah.
the point.
Yeah, yeah. Because obviously nuclear energy is great for growth and great for the third world and all that stuff. Anyway, the reason we're talking about nuclear energy in particular today is because we found an article from Forbes, which is a couple of weeks old, but that's all right, which found that had California... So it's reporting on a... research report from a mob called Environmental Progress in California.
The mob.
A mob. Not mob in a pejorative sense, but...
Not the mob outside Tucker Carlson's house.
No.
They did not do this report.
Mob as in group.
Yeah.
Organization who released this report that said, had California and Germany invested the $680 billion they spent on renewables on nuclear, they'd be generating 100% or more of their electricity with low emissions.
Now, I need to come in here because I don't think I'm the stupidest person in the world.
Well...
But I did feel it when you explained to me what 100% or more of their emissions meant.
Yeah, so we wrote...
My theory is that you can't go higher than 100%.
That's...
No matter what high school coaches tell you.
Yeah. I agree with that. You can't give 100%.
So what is 100% or more of their electricity?
Jurisdictions can store electricity and give it to other jurisdictions.
See, I can't be the only stupid person in the world who didn't follow what you meant when you said 100% or more.
That's what I meant, and that's what they can do. So had they done that, they'd be much better off. Germany would have decarbonised. Think about that. Germany could have decarbonised had they spent all that money on nuclear energy. That's no small thing. If Germany spent $580 million on renewables, it would have the energy to replace all fossil fuels and biomass in its electricity sector and replace all of the petroleum it uses. All of the petroleum it uses. Bit Alan Jones, that. It uses for cars and light trucks. Same with California.
So, Pete.
James.
You're telling me. You're sitting there and you're telling me that government getting involved in energy and picking winners is not a good thing.
Well, I mean...
Is that what you're telling me?
No, what I'm telling you is they picked the wrong winger in this case.
Yeah, but like the idea that they shouldn't have picked a winner in the first place.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's the thing.
They should have just gone, all right, you guys, you figure it out amongst yourselves and let's just see what happens.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that we should have complete deregulation of the nuclear industry, but in general, I take your point. Also, those who read the October edition of the review... The IPA review would have seen a piece by Dr. Ben Hurd, founder of Bright New World, on how nuclear energy is good for the environment. It's good for the environment.
All right. Another thing that is, bad for the environment and bad for people and bad for women, to bring up a constant theme in this show, the no growth movement. Pete, talk us through it.
Well, two in a row, this is a lot of stress, but I'll go. I'll do it.
I'm here with you, Pete. I'm here with you.
The no growth movement.
Should you fall, I shall catch you. Trust fall.
No, I won't fall if that's what the outcome is. But
damn it.
No growth.
I nearly had him falling.
The no growth movement is a movement of academics, EU politicians and activists who say that...
Chills down the spine. Those three get together.
Well, I mean, like there's any difference. But they say that to solve the environmental problems the world's having and to solve inequality programs, we need to stop growth. We have enough growth as it is. It's just a matter of redistributing it more effectively. Now, you might say, Peter, James, Nina, why are you guys getting up and about this? Let the crazy people think what they want. But this movement is growing and quite powerful. And as I said, includes EU politicians. They've had meetings all around the world in the last few months. Malmo, Brussels, Mexico City. 240 academics.
That's the richest thing I've ever heard, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
We've had conferences in Malmo, Brussels, and Mexico City, take us seriously.
We better have one, outside Europe to make it seem like we're diverse. But they sent a letter to the EU, 240 academics signed a letter to the EU pushing this stuff. So that's why I brought it up, because it is crazy. And Bjorn Lomborg wrote an excellent article about it on Project Syndicate, which is a good website, about how it's stupid, obviously. Firstly, because growth is good for poor people, and we shouldn't tell poor people that they don't have access to the same stuff that has greatly benefited all our lives. So that's the obvious point. But there's two really important points I want people to realize and to say when some Naomi Klein alkalite gets in their face at the pub. Number one.
At the pub.
Anywhere.
He does 95% of his social interactions near a front bar of some description.
That is my parents listening to this. Number one, we are not becoming more unequal. We are not. The world is not becoming more unequal. That is a lie. Okay, the World Bank in 2012 said we're less unequal now in 2012, which is a few years ago, than since the Industrial Revolution. Okay, so we're not becoming more unequal. Secondly, growth is good for the environment. Growth is good. Just let that sink in, because people will say, Peter, Nina, James, you're crazy, but that's true. Growth is good for the environment. As a country goes through a developing stage is generally when it does the worst things to the environment, because, factories are growing, blah, blah, blah. As you become richer... They start investing in more sophisticated technology, which isn't as damaging to the environment. You have the Maslow hierarchy of needs thing. People are rich enough to start caring about the environment. And agriculture becomes more sophisticated, so people don't need to decimate the environment to survive. They just go to Woolies. So growth is good for the environment.
My question to the panel, okay. Pete and Nina.
There's no panel.
It's just round table.
It's a round table. My question to the round table, should we find the Holy Grail? No. My question to the round table is, is there anything richer than hating economic growth?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, when we talk about, like, things rich people do, hating economic growth has got to be number one.
That is number one. Yeah, right. That, I agree.
Right.
So you're correct. Nina, what
followed
do you think?
By pumpkin spice lattes.
That's...
And then number three...
That's the drink of the people. What do you think, Nina?
It's renewable energy.
I don't get it why people, like, need to stop the growth, though.
Yeah,
I mean...
Because they're rich and they don't feel the effects.
Yeah, they don't feel like...
They can't remember being poor.
Yeah, or they've never been poor.
I think so, yeah. That could be a good theory of us all.
No, seriously, like, I haven't been to an EU conference, but, I've seen
people believe everyone's in the EU has, like, some wealth in them.
Yeah.
They don't believe that they're actually growing more.
No.
Because they already have it.
Mm.
But there are people who don't have it, like me. I love growth.
Nina loves growth.
I love growth.
Yeah, this is my most Daniel Wilde.
Like, physically and mentally, I love growth.
Growth is one of your things.
Yeah, I'm short.
It's very hard to pitch the benefits of economic growth to people that have never been outside of a 5-star hotel.
Yeah.
Like, that's just my theory.
Yeah.
No, good.
All right, cool. So last thing we'll get into. So we'll do a few IPA things and then we'll get into the interview. So last week on the show, we had Renee Gorman on. She's the national manager of the IPA's Generation Liberty program. We had a whole lot of kids come through on the emails. They wanted to get involved. They want to know which universities our campus coordinators are at. Once again, the goal is campus coordinator at every single Australian university. But here are the ones.
All 42 of them.
All 42.
And with... Sorry, you go.
And if there's a new university after that, you damn right we're getting a campus coordinator there. Let's talk about the universities where they are already. And if you are at a university, there's ways, just get involved with the Generation Liberty page. So we've got the University of Queensland, the University of Adelaide, Notre Dame Fremantle, Campion College, Queensland University of Technology, University of Melbourne, the University of Sydney, the University of Wollongong, Macquarie University, the University of New South Wales, Murdoch University in WA, the University of Western Australia. So if you're at any of those universities, get involved with Generation Liberty. A whole lot of fun. Our campus coordinators are absolutely fantastic. They're hosting a really cool range of events. And Nina, how many young members do we have?
At this point of time, we have 1,322 young members.
Very cool. Hot off the press. So there's a whole giant community of young IPA members out there. Make sure you're getting involved. And Nina is just about to tell us how to get involved with the IPA's membership program. And make sure if you're still at one of those universities that I read out, make sure you're getting involved with that Generation Liberty program. All right, so here's what else the IPA has done this week, which you guys can look at. A big one is the new Great Books of Literature podcast is out. This one's on The Way We Live Now by Anthony Trollope. It's a really interesting discussion. Basically, the book is about a really rich dude who gets elevated to social society to the point where he's asked to sit in the Houses of Parliament despite not having any political beliefs, doesn't really know which party he wants to join. Don't really need to know, tell you guys how much that could just as easily have been written today. So that's basically what Andrew and John talk about. So really interesting discussion between Andrew Bolt and John Roscombe. We've also got Matthew Lesh in The Mercury down in Tasmania talking about the University of Tasmania's risk to freedom of expression and human rights with their new conduct policy. So, I mean, campus censorship and conduct is a huge issue in Australia at the moment. And University of Tasmania is right there in Matthew's, what do they call it? Scope.
Yeah. Right.
What's the thing? And like this, the cross in the circle? Crosshairs. Yeah. Good one.
That's a bit violent.
Well, a bit violent, but read the article. And we've also got a bunch of blog posts from Jennifer Marahasi if you're interested in the subject of climate change. That's all available on the IPA's website. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening and downloading and subscribing to the show. Really cool stuff. So make sure we've got new episodes coming out every Friday. So make sure you're listening on Friday or over the weekend or whatever you do. And make sure you're telling your friends and family about the show. Available on iTunes, Podbean, which you can get on Android phones and through the IPA website. And make sure if you're listening to us on iTunes, you're leaving that 5-star review rating. You can leave a tip for the show, a tip for me and Pete.
Tell your friends. That's how podcasts grow.
That is how podcasts grow. That is the water in which the shoots shoot through.
Photosynthesis.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Science.
Yeah.
Biology. Unite. All right, Nina, if people want to join the IPA, especially the young members, the young people who want to become members, where can they go to become members?
Well, just visit the website, so ipa.au, where everything is available at that, and click on the join button and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to the solo James Bolt show with Tom Switzer, and then over to me and Pete giving Breeny his exit interview.
This is the way he wants to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Fascinating peek into the near future of the podcast.
Free of the chains that I represent. Anyway, let's go.
Let's do it. Okay, we now welcome onto the show Tom Switzer, the Executive Director of the Centre for Independent Studies and the host of Between the Lines on ABC Radio National. Tom, welcome to the show.
James, great to be with you.
Great to have you. So let's talk about it. So the US midterm election was this week. Now, that was, a lot of headlines come out of it. So we'll run through the takeaways. So the big thing was we're expected to see a blue wave. It was expected to be the Democrats taking back control of the House and the Senate. They got the House. They didn't get the Senate. So what happened to that blue wave?
Well, that's exactly right. I think that those commentators who only a few months ago were predicting that blue wave completely underestimated the impact of the Kavanaugh hearings. This is the Supreme Court nominee. He was accused of baseless accusations that he had harassed a lady in high school 35 years or so earlier. And that really galvanised the conservative Republican base, including, James, many of those Republicans who don't particularly like Donald Trump. So that was a turning point. And, all things considered, it's not a bad result for Donald Trump because usually the president's party takes a battering at his first midterm elections. Not always, but almost always. And on this occasion, although the House went the Democrat, the Republicans actually strengthened their gain in the Senate.
Yeah, cool. So let's talk about that. Are you as surprised as I am that a coalition of celebrities online telling people to vote wasn't able to get that blue wave over the line?
Yeah. Well, we've got to remember, we were told time and again during the Northern summer that the strong turnout among Democrats during the primaries meant a more motivated Liberal base than their Republican rivals. The Democrats, it has to be said, were raising a lot more money than the Republicans, money at record levels. Add to this the fact that something like 40 Republican incumbent representatives, they'd retired, and most from congressional districts where Trump's approval ratings were low. We had the Mueller probe into allegations of collusion that was handing out indictments. And then, as I said before, the history here where the president's party suffers big setbacks in the first midterm election. So there, a lot of Democrats and Liberal partisans were giddy with excitement that these midterm elections for Trump and the Republicans would be akin to the wipeout of Democrats under President Bill Clinton in 1994 and President Barack Obama in 2010. It wasn't like that at all.
Yeah, so when Trump said on Twitter after the election, like, very successful night or something to that effect, he was derided by a lot because he'd lost, like, the Republicans lost control of the House, but you reckon that's a pretty good one, that he didn't have as many seats lost?
Yeah, well, Donald Trump, is incapable of understatement. I wouldn't say it was a great victory.
He could have been impeached that night and he still would have said it's a successful night for his administration.
Yeah, but Look, the Democrats could overplay their hands here, of course. They're in a confrontational mood. And if they go down that impeachment path, I think it'll only blow up in their faces. And, of course, it's meaningless because the Republicans control the Senate comfortably now, and you need two-thirds of the Senate to convict after an impeachment. But the Democrats, I think, are in real trouble here because there's no national leader. They're really divided on a wide range of issues between the establishment third-way type Democrats and the more left-wing socialist types. And, it's not altogether clear what their agenda is now beyond bagging Trump in the lead-up to the 2020 elections.
I mean, I think that's what the Democrats have been doing for the last few years as well, is just, just bag Trump. Like, if anything pops up, just bag Trump, and then something will happen.
Yeah, but, the obvious response to that is, for all of Trump's flaws, as my Republican friends in America say, don't listen to what he says, look at what he's done. And the reality is, and this is important for groups like IPA and CIS, the tax cuts, both company and income tax reforms under both Trump and the Republican Congress, taken together with deregulation, that's helped create today's booming economy in the United States. We have record low unemployment of 3.7%. Now, that's the lowest jobless rate since 1969, nearly 50 years ago, since man landed on the moon, James. And, of course, you've got a booming economy. You've got an annual growth rate of something like 3.5%, which is far higher than the 1.6% mean under the Obama era.
Absolutely. So we now have the House. The House is now controlled by the Democrats. Republicans control the Senate. Now, how much of a problem is this going to be for the U.S. going forward with that sort of thing happening? Because in Australia, that can really drag out. You have the government just completely unable to pass any legislation. What does that sort of mean for the U.S.? Are they going to have a similar problem?
Probably. I mean, Robert Gates, who was the Defense Secretary under Presidents Bush Jr. and then Obama, he once said that the greatest national security threat to the United States, and these are his words, is the 2 square miles that encompasses the Capitol building, that's Congress, and the White House. And he made those remarks, Gates made those remarks in 2014, well before Trump arrived on the scene. So if Gates and people like him thought that congressional gridlock, policy dysfunction, infighting, they thought it was a big problem then, 4 years ago, I think it's fair to say it's bound to become an even bigger problem during the next 2 years. And this goes beyond Trump. Let's remember, a lot of Democrats, a lot of left-wingers are very polarizing, very partisan themselves. I mean, this idea of going into restaurants and harassing Republican lawmakers, kicking them out of restaurants, harassing Trump administration cabinet secretaries at their home. You know, this polarization goes beyond Trump, James.
Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about a few of the celebrity candidates that the Democrats had, because there was a big night, like they're getting back control of the House, but a lot of the big players for the Democrats didn't get the win, and especially Beto O'Rourke down in Texas. That was a huge campaign. I think over $100 million was spent in that campaign between Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz. Beto was unable to get over the line. Do you reckon, is this setting up to a Beto 2020? Like, is he the Democratic leader that you said the Democrats desperately need?
Look, I just don't know. And frankly, anyone who says they know just doesn't know what they're talking about. 2 years is a long time in politics. You go back to the 1990 midterm elections, well before you were born, James. I don't remember anyone talking about Bill Clinton. And yet, within 2 years, a draft-dodging, marijuana-smoking, womanizing governor of a backwater state, Bill Clinton, went on to knock off a war hero in George H.W. Bush. In 2006, the midterm elections, no one really thought that Barack Obama would emerge within 2 years to not just win the Democrat primaries, but also to knock off the Republican Senator John McCain. And of course, you go back to 2014, if I had told you that Donald Trump would be the Republican presidential candidate and would win the 2016 election and would have a decent chance of being re-elected, you'd want to know what I was smoking. So the point here is, you just don't know. I mean, it's a very volatile environment, and frankly, this is a Democrats' problem. There's no one really there, but that's not necessarily a problem because we didn't know Clinton or Obama and certainly Trump.
Yeah, it's true. But do you reckon like Beto O'Rourke just really seems to have the charm and charisma that people can really get around? I mean, he nearly beat Ted Cruz in Texas.
Yeah, but he lost, though. He lost.
Did, yeah.
I think if he won, we'd be having this conversation, but
right.
He lost.
Okay.
And Cruz won by, what, 3 points?
Yeah, it was very close, yeah. Oh, well, yeah, I suppose that's close. A bit of a daylight, yeah.
Yeah, but he lost. I mean, this is the important point. It's a bit like this gubernatorial candidate for the Democrats in Georgia. Stacey Abrams, an African-American, if she won, she'd be the darling of the media, but she's going to lose. So, more than likely going to lose. I think they're still going through the process. But you've got to win these races to be taken seriously.
Absolutely. All right, so let's change tracks. So, you're Executive Director of the Center of Independent Studies, and last week you hosted Dan Hannon for the annual John
Bonathan. Great man.
Great man. So, great friend of the show, John Bonathan Lecture. So, we had Dan Hannon on the show last week. We talked a lot about Brexit, and I know his lecture to you guys was on a slightly different topic. So, what were your reflections from spending time with Hannon and hearing what he had to say?
Well, among other things, I met Dan in 2007 in Brussels, of all places. I went to Europe. I was on one of these visitors' programs to the European Union. And the French diplomats said I could meet anyone I wanted to at the European Parliament in Strasbourg, and I nominated Dan Hannon because I'd been reading his articles in the Daily Telegraph in London as well as a Spectator, and they said to me, well, he's not one of us. To which I replied, I'm not sure I'm one of you either. And so Dan and I got on like a house on fire. We've been friends since, and I've actually done a couple of events with Dan at the IPA, and now in my new role, relatively new role at CIS, we hosted him about a week or so ago, and he was outstanding. He was just making the point that identity politics is a real cancer. This idea of dividing people by race, religion, gender, it goes against the very principles of meritocracy. And frankly, he had the crowd in the palm of his hands. As you know, he's one of the most inspirational, articulate speakers in the world. He was outstanding.
Yeah, he was absolutely brilliant. But let's get your opinions on Brexit. Sorry, the identity politics stuff is fantastic, what Hannon says. But what do you make of where Brexit is at the moment?
Well, mixed feelings. I mean, look, I'm a Brexiteer in the sense that I strongly support that the British people should reaffirm national sovereignty, and the idea of unelected and unaccountable bureaucrats in Brussels deciding national laws is abhorrent to every bone in my body. But on the other hand, I think a lot of the people who voted for Brexit didn't know that it would come with so many strings attached. If it was clear that you could get a free trade deal between Westminster and Brussels, that's great. But it's conceivable we may not get such a deal. And if the British don't get a deal, what happens then? Now they'll play by WTO rules. That's okay, I suppose. But the indications from a lot of businesses is that they will hurt if there's no deal, and that could lead to short-term pain throughout the latter half of 2019.
But don't you feel that the reason that there is so little belief in what the deal is going to look like and such little clarity is because there's so many people at the top who are so actively working against Brexit, which is against the will of what was voted for in that referendum?
Well, there's a lot of truth to that, James. I mean, the Tories as well as the Labor Party are very divided. The Tories come in Brexiteers, but they also come in the form of Remainers. I mean, David Cameron, of course, and George Osborne, the Shadow Chancellor, were campaigning strongly for remaining, whereas Boris Johnson and Dan Hannan, two of the most impressive Tories today in Britain, they were strong advocates of leaving. So there's a lot of divisions there. But let's remember that the Labor Party themselves are divided. Something like 7 out of 10 Labor constituencies voted to leave. And yet the Labor Party parliamentary representation, it would probably be 7-10 the other way around.
I think so that's even a bit conservative. I reckon it's 8 or 9.
Maybe. So you've got, and you know, there's a real divide there between the parliamentary representations of a lot of these parties and the rank and file, and that's a real betrayal of democracy. But going forward, if there's no deal by the end of March, I do fear for Britain for the short term, because where are they going to get the stimulus?
But do you also feel that, you said how there's a lot of companies saying that this is going to have short-term hurt, and there's a lot of political organisations saying how bad it's going to be for the next 6 months. But weren't they the same people that were saying how bad it was going to be immediately after the Brexit vote? And that didn't really pan out either. I mean, unemployment's falling in Britain.
No, a lot of people have been crying wolf, and maybe I'm being a bit conservative about all this. And I think the media self-serving in many respects, because a lot of these media outlets themselves were strong supporters of Remain, most notably the Financial Times and the Guardian. But we wait and see. We're in uncharted territory, and what makes a bad situation worse, of course, is the very precarious nature of the May leadership. Theresa May is bleeding authority and credibility as if from an open wound. Usually I wouldn't be too worried about this, but when you have a socialist leader in Jeremy Corbyn breathing down her neck, that's a real concern.
Absolutely. All right, we'll go change tracks again. So you talked about identity politics and talking about that with Dan Hannan earlier. Now, you are in Sydney, Centre of Independent Studies. That's out of Sydney, which is right near the University of Sydney. And that's been ground zero for a whole lot of the problems with identity politics at the moment, especially that protest against Bettina Arndt. What do you make of where identity politics
well,
is taking
look,
this
we had a bit of this last year with the debate over same-sex marriage. CIS did not take a position on same-sex marriage, but we certainly believed in freedom of speech and religious freedoms. I think it's got to a stage now, James, and this is not an isolated view. I know that IPA has done some outstanding work on this question, but there are many serious subjects now, it seems to me, that can't be discussed openly without inspiring mass hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
We saw saw that last year with the same-sex marriage debate, when people who held traditional views of marriage, whether they be Christians, but they're mainly Christians, but also Jews and Muslims, they'd be demonised as unfit to be engaged in polite society. I mean, that's a real problem. It's a real problem in our society. I thought that the many of the marriage equality advocates, a lot of them were very, very well-meaning people, and they did a good job of campaigning for love and respect. But some of them, the paradox of their agenda was that they showed no love or respect or tolerance for those who held a different view.
Yes, exactly.
And you see this across a wide range of issues. And another one, of course, is Western civilization. And you're seeing this right now playing out on the campuses at the University of Sydney campus.
Yeah, I was watching the CNN coverage of the midterms yesterday, and we had one panelist say, you know, I really, like, he was a Democrat supporter, and he said, I'm heartbroken by tonight. I thought this was going to be a rejection of hatred. And then 20 seconds later says, look, we as Democrats, we have to maintain the outrage. And I just thought, well, hang on, can I just bring you back to what you said 20 seconds ago about let's have a little less hatred? But yeah, it's just the division of society. I think you talked about that in your article on the midterms as well. Just it really reveals how toxic society is among people that believe different things.
Well, it shouldn't get to a stage where one of our most distinguished and oldest universities, and I think we should reserve judgment completely. You know, the Chancellor and the Vice-Chancellor may well decide that Ramsay is a good fit for Sydney University, but they're being bullied and harassed by many radicals on the left. And the question I'd ask those radicals is, would they be all up in arms if a prominent philanthropist who died bequested his money for a Confucius Institute or an Institute for Islamic Studies? They would have no qualms with it. But because it's Western civilization, they get their knickers in a knot. And I think by denouncing advocates or defenders of teaching Western civilization as racist, they really hurt their cause.
Absolutely. All right, we've got one final question. So the Centre of Independent Studies, it is such a fantastic organisation coming out of Sydney. What are some of the areas you guys are looking at the moment?
Bit of overlap with the IPA. I mean, we're interested in economics, education and culture increasingly. Last night, this was Wednesday night of the midterm elections, I don't usually indulge in hubris, James, but I was nevertheless boasted that CIS was the world's first think tank to have a think tank debate the midterm election results. Time difference allows us that luxury. So we had a big debate with Greg Sheridan, the foreign editor of The Australian, April Parmalee, she's the head of the American Chamber of Commerce here in Australia, and Bob Carr, the former foreign minister. We had a great crowd, about 120 people packed into our lecture room. There's a lot of enthusiasm. But we're working on immigration right now. This is a big red hot button subject.
Yeah, speaking of ones, they set off a tinderbox of emotions whenever you bring it up.
Well, indeed, and I think a lot of this controversy in Europe particularly reaffirms John Howard's point that I know the IPA and CIS strongly supported at the time of the 2001 Tampa asylum seeker standoff, that we will determine who comes to this country and the circumstances in which they come. Just a reaffirmation of democratic sovereignty. And we're going to be pushing that issue hard over the next few months. So we're commissioning polling that really reaffirms that simple principle.
Great. Can't wait to read what you guys come up with. So, Tom Switzer, Executive Director of the Centre for Independent Studies, host of Between the Lines on ABC Radio National. Make sure you're listening to that. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much, James.
No worries. Okay, we now welcome on to the podcast, and this one with a bit of a heavy heart beat. We welcome on Simon Breeny for potentially the last time.
G'day.
Hopefully not.
Well, not the last time, I hope, but certainly the last time as Director of Policy in this era.
In this era.
Well, you know, who knows what the future may bring.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. He could come back.
No river long enough that doesn't contain a bend. But that is why we're here. So, Simon, you are wrapping up as Policy Director of the IPA.
I am indeed.
Yes, moving on to big-time corporate job.
That's right. Yes, moving on to the corporate world.
Let's play Time of Your Life by Green Day.
Oh, we should. Yep.
I'm both excited and very sad because the job that I'm moving to, I'm really excited about. And I think it's great that we see IPA staff all the time move on to great things. And I'm also very sad because I've spent the last 6.5 years working with you wonderful people and all the wonderful staff and members and supporters of the IPA, and it really has been an enormous privilege to be a part of the team. So it's a bit sad, but you know, we've all got other things that we want to go on and achieve and do. So I'm really happy about that, but yeah, it is a bit sad. But I'll look back on the last 6.5 years with a lot of pride.
So 6.5 years is actually a very long time. I didn't realise it was that long. What are some of your...
Especially because I've been here longer than Brini, so I'm really just reflecting.
Yeah, you have. Yeah.
Same. So what the obvious question is, what are some of the highlights of your time?
Yeah, look, I think no doubt the work that we've done over the years on freedom of speech has been a huge highlight for me. I think the work that we've done on Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, I think we really have changed the debate on that issue. And I think that more broadly, we've actually changed the debate on freedom of speech, and we've brought freedom of speech to the fore in terms of the political debate and where the policy debates are at the moment. And I think I've got to say my proudest achievement within the freedom of speech space was the work that the IPA did on the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill back in 2013. I think that the work that we did really did knock off that bill. In the end, it would have been a massive expansion of Section 18C into a whole range of other areas. And the research that we did and the dissemination of that research, I think, led to the demise of that bill.
Yeah, we got a lot of young listeners. Do you want to expand on what that Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill was?
Yeah.
Because that was terrifying.
Yeah. So Section 18C makes
it
awful to... Yeah,
so
maybe there's some good to it.
So Section 18C makes it unlawful to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate someone on the basis of race, colour or national or ethnic origin. What the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill would have done is it would have expanded that definition. The definition would have remained the same, but it would have expanded the number of what were called protected attributes. So it wouldn't just have been race, or national or ethnic origin. It would have expanded it to a whole range of things, including things like political opinion. So... this was in the...
Definitely would have been off the air.
Yeah, that's right. So in the context of the workplace, if you said something that had the potential to offend someone, you would have fallen foul of the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill. So it would have been a huge, huge expansion. And I think it was a huge overreach by the Attorney General at the time, Nicola Roxon, and the Gillard government. So I think that our work in highlighting how significant this was, we read the bill. I remember... I think it was the 20th of November 2012, we saw this news story talking about it. We downloaded the bill, we read it back to front. I think it was about 200 pages. We went through and worked out what provisions we thought were the worst, and we highlighted those and we brought those to the attention of the public. And I think that was really, really important in bringing about the end of the bill.
Yeah, because especially where like offence culture has got to, could you imagine if like taking someone to court for making you offended about your political beliefs at work, like the amount of cases there would be right
of course
now.
Of course. Well, particularly given the debates that we've had, I mean, you know, the policy debates that we've had over the last few years, I think have been pretty red hot, and to have thought that you could amplify the way that you attack your political opponents through using the law and using the courts, I think that would have been a very dangerous thing. And I think people already are pretty careful about what they say at work, and you know, a lot of the time I think people keep themselves in check, and I think that the threat of a lawsuit hanging over your head is just such a dangerous thing. So I'm so glad that bill never got passed.
You mentioned, so obviously that's a pretty discreet legislative achievement. You mentioned changing the conversation. I think that's really true.
I think it's called normalizing the conversation.
Yeah.
Which is, so, you know, that's what they say we do.
Yeah.
That's very true.
We
James.
Normalize free speech.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm glad that you raised that.
That's terrible. Yeah. I think we have changed. I really do think we have changed I think we've changed the policy landscape when it comes to freedom of speech. I don't think that freedom of speech was anywhere near the issue that it was. That it is today. When we look back at the late 90s and the early 2000s, I just don't think it was that big an issue for Australians. And if you look at other parts of the world, the United States, for instance, there are constantly these debates going on about freedom of speech. And I think that that's been a fairly constant thing over a period of time, whereas for Australia, that hasn't been the case. And I think that the work that we have done on 18C in particular, but the debate more generally, I mean, we went through when we wrote our 18C submission through all of the areas of freedom of speech that we've touched on over the years, and there's a page in the submission where we literally just go through and talk about each of the areas that we've looked at. And I think that all of that work has really brought freedom of speech to the fore. When we think about politics, freedom of speech is one of the key issues that we think about and that we talk about and that we discuss.
I think I can see that, like, in my Facebook pages when I see my mates from the country who play footy posting about freedom of speech, and guys I play cricket with who aren't political at all talking about how 18C is a thing. I think that's
incredible.
Yeah. Like, they're not political at all, these people. Anyway.
Cool. The other one. So when you came to the IPA, I remember you were, like, strictly the legal affairs kind of guy, just talking law.
Yeah.
And now
talking
you're
the law.
The law.
Yeah.
Not any law. The law. But now you're, like, on the Bolt Report discussing, you know, the day in politics. You're on every single issue. What do you, like, what's that development been like for you?
Yeah, so I started at the IPA as a researcher, and within a couple of months I became the director of what we called the Rule of Law Project. A
couple of months promotion.
It became a really important part of what we were doing. So we were looking at things like retrospectivity. We were looking at a whole range of other things which weren't strictly about the rule of law. They were more broadly about legal rights. So we rebranded the project and we called it the Legal Rights Project. And Morgan Begg is now doing a terrific job looking at most of those issues. But what we looked at were things like the presumption of innocence, the right to silence, etc. And then from that, I guess we got involved in a whole range of debates because we recognised that legal rights were being infringed in a whole range of laws, and that allowed us to get into lots of different areas. And from that, I think the research area expanded out into lots of other areas of policy. And I was really lucky that that I was in the position that I was, and that those opportunities came my way. And I mean, one of the real reflections I've got is that the opportunities I've been given by John Roskam and by the IPA have just been incredible. I mean, to go and appear before Senate inquiries, to go and write submissions to those inquiries, to appear on TV and radio, to have done the quality research that we do, I just think, you know, these are opportunities that you just don't get anywhere else. And I think for someone on the centre right of politics at the moment, the IPA is really the leading light, and to be a part of that community of people who are really passionate about freedom, I think is an incredible thing and a real honour.
Yeah, so absolutely. But, like, I'm also talking, like, when you get here, you're only talking about law, and I don't know what you've been talking about at the Bolt Report, but I'm assuming it's, like, you know, which minister's doing well or not, or, like, climate change policy, electricity policy. Like, what's that development been where you're like, you know what? I need to start learning about these issues.
Yeah, so, I mean, a huge part of being at the IPA is just knowing what is going on in news and current affairs, and I think that that has been a skill that you pick up over the years because if you want to be aware of your own research area, you have to read the paper and you've got to know what is happening and you have to watch Sky News.
I was just about
to start writing this stuff down. That's good.
So, I mean, these are the sorts of things that I think you've got to do. And I think once you are really comfortable in one research area, you can then expand out into other areas. So you might become an expert in one particular policy area, and then because you've built up an area of expertise and you've built up a body of research, I think that gives you the confidence to move out into lots of other areas, which then you're asked to discuss when you go on panels, for instance. Panel shows, for instance, are a real challenge. I mean, when you're young and you're first getting into this stuff, I think it's a bit daunting to try and jump into that, but I think it's a really important thing to do, and I think that the opportunity to do that has come to me, which I'm really thrilled about. But I think that that's only because I've been able to build up a body of research in a particular area.
Mm. And I suppose it's also like something we take for granted, the IPA, is that we're all on the same team. There's no egos, like, oh, this is my area. Like, if you need help with someone who's like an expert in that field, they're so happy to help you out. They're not just like, well, this is my area, I'll do it instead.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that is I think the big part of why that is and why there's such collegiality and unity at the IPA is because we are all pushing in the same direction. You know, we all are in favour of small government. We're all in favour of individuals being able to make decisions about their own lives. We don't think that governments and politicians and bureaucrats should be empowered to make those decisions on individuals' behalf. So I think that means that in terms of the philosophical direction, because we're all on the same page, we're all moving in the same direction, we all recognise that we've all got the same goals. And so I think that really helps to bring the team together and to work as well together as we do.
So I haven't given you any warning for this question, which makes it a little bit difficult, but if you could pick one highlight, one moment, one event, what would it be?
That is very tough. I mean, I really do think that the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill is probably the most significant highlight. But I have to say, this is really soppy, but I think it really is.
Do I need to play Time of Your Life again?
Yeah, you do. Cool. Yeah.
All right. I'll just have it underneath what you're about to say.
Yeah. Bit of Celine Dion here, I think. It really has been a privilege to meet some incredible people at the IPA, and the thing that I'll take, I mean, I think the opportunities I've had, I think a lot of listeners of this program will be aware of, which I think is you know, awesome for me. I think that's been terrific. But I think that the real thing that I'll take away is the incredible people that I've met along the way. I would never, were it not for working at the IPA, I would never have met some amazing people, you know, people like John and James Patterson, who's gone into the Senate, and Tim Wilson, who's gone into the House. I think all of these people, Chris Berg, who's gone to do incredible things in academia, and all of my colleagues over the years, particularly the research team, who I've had the pleasure of managing over the last little while. And I think that those people are some of the smartest people I've ever met, and I think their contributions to the way that I think about the world is something that will always be with me. I wouldn't be the person that I am without having met those people and talked to those people, and I think those discussions have just been incredibly important. So I'm not sure that that's one highlight, but certainly a series of highlights that to me are incredibly important.
My highlight for you, Simon, is when... So we used to have a staff member here, Rob Thayer, and he and I would sort of like head up our video team. It was very, in its adolescent phase. It's certainly not, you know, we're looking around the studio right now. I got like dolly cameras and all these lights and stuff. It was very new. And we started to do these like in-house projects. And Rob and I quickly developed the nickname Giggles for Breeny, because no man has ever been more serious on camera in his starting phase than Simon Breeny. And what I liked about that was like, you worked so hard at it that now it's like you're our regular, like you're our IPA media guy, but they don't know what I know. Really. They don't know where you started.
Yeah, that's true. I think Giggles and Robo Breeny were epithets that were thrown around the office from time to time. And I think that is a reflection on
Rob.
On the difficulty of working with these colleagues that I've been heaping praise on. But I went back recently and I saw a video even earlier than when I started at the IPA from I think it was 2007 or something, where they're asking me a series of questions, and it is just the worst interview. You know, I'm sitting there absolutely deadpan. I'm completely nervous. You know, I think that a big part of it is just getting used to it and spending time doing it over and over and over and over again. I think it's really like any skill. But I think it's I think that's a great reflection on how far people can come.
All right, but on a serious note, Breeny, on a very serious note, who are you going to miss more, me or Pete?
Could be a nil or draw, then.
It's very serious.
Probably, man.
Who's Pete?
Oh, shots of fire.
He knows who edits shots the interview. That's why I said that.
Yeah, that's it. I could have edited this very badly. It would have been like rock bottom on The Simpsons. But yeah, Breeny, do you have like any final words you want to say to listeners or members, people who've been with you on this journey?
There is really an important thing that I really do need to say, which is that the IPA doesn't exist without its members. And I have been really lucky over the years to meet so many incredible people, some of whom have got incredible stories of their own to tell about their own lives or their business lives. And I think that the IPA wouldn't be what it is without those 5,000 members who pay their membership fees every year. The IPA wouldn't be what it is without the very generous donors to the IPA who support our research. And I really am so thankful to all of them for giving me the opportunities, because as much as the management at the IPA have to make decisions about who they hire, it really is the support of our donors that gives us the opportunities to do what we do. And I have loved every minute of working at the IPA. So thank you so much to our members and supporters.
All right, cool. Simon Bruni, outgoing policy director of the IPA. We will see you later on when we pat you down for all the stationery that you're going to stuff into your pockets. But thank you for coming on the show as often as you have, and certainly today.
Thanks, James and Pete. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, thank you to Tom Switzer and Simon Bruni for those interviews.
Wasn't bad.
What? Oh, my performance? Okay, thank you. Look, I'll take it. Let us get into some stories that made us laugh this week, and none made me laugh harder than this one. So One Nation had a huge announcement earlier this week that Mark Latham was going to be joining the team, basically heading up One Nation in New South Wales, and he's going to be future state MP. Big announcement, big fish, and, you know, former head of the Labor Party. Big deal.
Yeah.
He was almost
Prime Minister, wasn't he?
Almost to an election. And so what they did was they wanted to have an interview, and Pauline Hanson's office unequivocally told Studio 10 that the previous day to this, that her and Latham would be side by side together at Studio 10 talking about the big announcement.
Mm-hmm.
Latham does not show up. So my question for the roundtable, second one, is that good?
Ooh.
If you're One Nation, do you like the fact that Latham does not turn up to this thing?
You go first, Nina.
I believe in first impressions.
Sorry, really? Not good?
Not good.
All right. I remember the first time I met you.
You're not good, Pete.
Nah, well, I...
Is that good?
No, I mean, clearly it's not good.
So not good. All right, so...
to turn up.
Podcasters decided, not good. Not a good look.
No, not a good
look. Not a good look at all. So that, I mean, that is pretty bad.
It is.
Yeah.
It is pretty bad. So has there been any sort of, what's the word, aftermath on what actually happened? Not that.
Well, so Latham says that no one told Channel 10 that that he would appear.
No one told him.
Yeah, so Studio 10, their line is, Hanson told us both of them would be there together.
Yeah.
And then Latham says, there was absolutely no way I told you I'd be there.
Okay.
So there's still a lot of like, who said what? Amazing. So they still went ahead with the interview with just Pauline Hanson sitting next to an empty chair.
Yeah.
Like, there's just an empty chair sitting there the whole way through. Like, Clint Eastwood's on the next plane over to go yell at that empty chair.
I don't quite understand what that means, but okay.
Two people did, they would have laughed. But the idea, like, great idea by the producer to have that empty chair there, because that is a sign.
And I saw a little bit of that interview, and she was, Pauline Hanson was talking as if he should have been there.
Yeah. So, and I think at one point said, like, I don't know where he is right now.
Yep.
Again,
yep.
Is that good?
That's still not good.
I mean, yeah. So I guess, and it's probably done over the phone, so it might never come out.
Yeah. So rocky start to the Latham era at One Nation.
It was a rocky start. I did see a clip on Tim Wilson's Facebook page the other day, which I found very amusing. He was speaking on some television program, which I'm not exactly sure which one, with Anne Ali from the Labor Party, who I think has... destroyed IPA publications before, if my memory serves me correctly.
I think you're right, yeah.
Which is always a good look to be destroying books. But she, he said, put your hand up if you've never voted for, what's his name?
Mark Latham
as...
what's his name?
Prime Minister.
What's...
with that very...
he doesn't look back on past elections. He's looking forward to the next one.
That's right, look to the future. But he had that very Tim Wilson look on his face, like, I know I've got you here. And it was very funny. Check it out.
It was very, very good. All right, sorry, that was funny. And hopefully there are future interviews with one or both of them there, so we can watch them and
see what happens.
See what happens. Shall we talk veganism?
That's right. Let's talk veganism. One of my favourite topics. Waitrose food editor William Sitwell in the United Kingdom has been sacked because of an email he wrote, which included offensive comments about vegans. Now, Waitrose are the same mob that had that gentleman's sandwich, if you remember, James. And
yes.
Nina, which people complained about.
The gentleman's Caesar smoked... roll.
Oh,
no.
It sounded absolutely disgusting, like with anchovies or something.
Yeah, anchovy paste. That's what made it the gentleman's thing.
It sounded horrific, and I think some people on Twitter thought that it had a penis and complained about it, but it was just a sandwich. But anyway, that's fine. So they've had
go back and listen to last week's show. Yeah. Pete really came into his own in that segment. Very funny stuff.
They've had a rough run because they're not like a supermarket. But anyway, the food people at Waitrose. Now, what happened was this journalist emailed William Sitwell asking him about a series of articles on plant-based meals. Stilwell said, how about a series on killing vegans one by one? Ways to trap them, how to interrogate them properly, expose their hypocrisy, force-feed them meat, make them eat steak and drink red wine. Now, that's pretty full-on now that I've read it out loud. Now, this journo, Mark, this guy did not realise, was a vegan.
Mm. Oh.
And they cracked it and sent it to BuzzFeed, which published it and which started the Twitter storm, because that's what BuzzFeed do. And you got the sack.
Mm.
Now, obviously, the important thing is this was a joke in private. This was not even a joke in public.
Yeah, he didn't tweet this or say it at a rally where he just, you know, let the story get away from him.
That's right. And look, as I wrote yesterday, I was surprised because vegans normally don't take themselves this seriously. I was surprised there was a backlash.
Mm, yeah, absolutely. So my one is, like, you know, he shouldn't have been sacked, and it's weird that jokes in private can blow up in your face like that.
Yep.
You can't email a journalist that.
Oh, yeah, that's
You cannot email a journalist that. Well, I don't care how off the record you are, you cannot email a journalist that.
Yeah, that is a bit
like,
odd.
That's silly.
But the bloke does work in, like, food.
Yeah, but he's been like on MasterChef. Like, if someone sat him down and be like, oh, by the way, here's how to, you know, talk to the media. Because if you're on MasterChef, you're going to be in front of the media.
That's what, but he's coming from a very much different
climate
than us, James.
All right. Well, I also...
I do take your point.
I you know, like a phoenix, I reckon we can build something from this ashes. So, look, I'm not a fan of, like, a series that kills vegans and, you know, traps them, interrogates them.
Oh, we love vegans.
But I want to... There's stuff at the end here about force-feeding them meat, making them eat steak and drink red wine. Can I pitch a TV show where it's just me being fed steak and red wine? And I just sit there for a while and then I get paid and then I eat more steak and red wine. How do we feel about that?
We'll have to take that offline and think about it.
Off the record.
We'll call you.
You'll call me. Yeah. Well, you have my number.
I've lost it.
We're damaged.
So,
All right. I still think it's a good show. Cool. All right. I'll move on to this one. So speaking of television. So Dutch television personality and I like this one. Self-styled positivity guru. Emil Ratelband is taking legal action to lower his age by 20 years in a move he says will push back against age discrimination and boost his dating prospects. The things blokes will do. So basically, this guy's he's 69 years old, right? And he wants to date, and he says, I can't date as many people as I want to because I'm 69. I would rather be 49. And in the world of making sure that there's no discrimination ever, you know, this is his theory. He should be able to legally change his age to 49 years old.
So he's not. Is he taking the Mickey, or is he dead serious?
Pete, anyone that is allowed to has allowed people to describe them as a self-styled positivity guru is not taking like the Mickey.
Well, he's very optimistic.
Yes. Well, is he? Because like, surely a positivity guru is like, hey, make the best of a bad situation. If you don't feel 69, then you know, do something about like do positive things about it.
Yeah.
They're very negative to go to court and say, I want to be 20 years younger.
Well,
that's not a positive aspect. Like, that's not a positive way of being 69.
He's also potentially like a bit, not potentially. He is obviously quite delusional that he thinks that just changing the number of his age is going to overcome all the dysfunctional personality flaws he's got that are clearly preventing him from getting a date.
Yeah. And the other one I've got from this one is if you want people...
Why'd you laugh at the word dysfunction, Nina?
I have no idea. It just triggered me.
Oh, triggered. Oh, no. Oh, boy. Stop the podcast. All right. We'll keep going. My thing is, if you want people to stop thinking that you're 69 years old, the best thing to do is to go to court and bring a lot of media attention to the fact that you're 69 years old.
There you go.
That's how to do it.
This has also come on the back of that bloke in Canada who changed his age. No, he wanted to change his gender to get cheaper car insurance premiums.
Well, that guy was taking the Mickey. That guy, you know, he found out that insurance costs less if he was a woman, so he's like, all right, I'm a woman.
Yep.
But this guy
in that
is
voice
like
as well.
Yeah. And that dead band. But this guy is saying, I want to get it back out there on the dating scene.
Yeah, I'm ready to
ready to meet people that I want to meet people, and the first thing I do is lie about my age by 2 decades.
Because that's a great way to build a loving relationship.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, we'll keep on track of this over the coming weeks.
Oh, won't I ever.
Because this is...
You're talking like I haven't installed 15 different Google alerts for this bloke.
James
this
is on this, all right? Do not worry, James is on this, because this has actually been texted to me by like 3 different people. Like, this has caught the imagination of everyone, so we'll keep you posted.
Yeah, rarely on this show do we all get together on a Friday morning and we've all individually seen the exact same story.
Yeah.
Like, it's usually like, oh, this happened, but yeah. All three of us are like, we have to talk about this.
I didn't know the midterms had happened until you guys told me, but they had.
You're too busy reading about a meal.
But I knew this one.
All right, cool. So I'll go... who's doing Long Time No Save?
I'll do Long Time No Save because you've got to do that other thing.
Yeah. Bit of live producing for you out there.
Long Time No Save. If you haven't listened on the podcast for a while, I won't say Long Time No See. Keen-eyed readers of, hey, what did I miss? Well, no, I used that gag yesterday. But anyway, Colorado State University administrators have designated the common greeting Long Time No See as non-inclusive language. That is according to student Katrina Leiby, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing your name correctly. She writes for the Rocky Mountain Collegian. She met Zara Al-Saloom, also... apologies if I'm not saying your name properly.
They're both listeners, so they'll know.
They might be. We've got listeners in Sweden. Director of Diversity and Inclusion at CSU.
Colorado State University.
Very good. Who showed her a list of terms and phrases considered contrary to the university's mission of fostering inclusion. One of these phrases was long time no see, which is viewed as derogatory towards those of Asian descent.
Mm.
That's the story.
So the obvious thing for me, so we talk about how a lot of these are kind of dog whistles where, you know, if you think these phrases are offensive, then you're really like listening out for that offense.
Mm.
Is long time no see the biggest dog whistle ever? Like, has anyone ever put that together?
That is not.
That there's like, you know,
no.
Comments like that could be taken racially.
No. Yep. So that was one that tickled our fancies this week. Right. They come in every week. So.
They do. All right.
It's good because we need stuff to talk about.
Yes. So this is going to be the last thing in the show, and new segment. New segment. Yeah, so
fresh new.
It's everyone, like new segment every week.
Yeah, but this is...
That's true.
Nina, we're on the same team here. Sorry, new segment.
We're trying to think of segments.
Thank you. Okay, cool. All right. So it's going to be this podcast, you know, we have a lot of fun because we agree on a lot of things. We see the world in very similar ways.
Mm. Well, more
similar senses of humor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what the idea is... So throw a bit of tension into the mix.
Yeah,
to dust off the sparring gloves and see me and Pete go mano a mano.
We do need more disagreement.
We do need more tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're going to do, so usually we do a Q&A clap moment where we find something stupid around the world.
We both agree.
We both agree that something's funny enough for a Q&A clap moment, and then we both agree to give it the Q&A clap moment. And then what we're going to do now is we found one particularly stupid thing, mm-hmm. and we're going to have a debate as to whether or not Joy Behar is right. So let's see how this goes. All right. So Joy Behar, they're talking on The View. They're talking about the US midterm elections. Now, one thing that was getting brought up, especially in the House seats, was gerrymandering. The idea that, you know, it's redistributing...
Changing electoral boundaries.
That's the one. To make sure that some seats win and some seats don't.
Yeah.
Joy Behar had this to say.
Democrats won the popular vote last night by 8 million votes. Right? They lose, but they lose U.S. Senate races in red areas. Mm-hmm.
Because of gerrymandering,
That's the Constitution. I mean, you can't, the districts are gerrymandered, but the states are part of the Constitution.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, Pete and I are now going to debate the topic. Did the U.S. Founding Fathers redistribute... did they draw up the states of the Northeast and all over America? The Louisiana Purchase, was that made so that the 2018 Republican Party could carry the US Senate?
Who's going first? Well, who's affirmative and who's negative?
I'll take affirmative.
Okay, and I'm negative.
Okay.
And who's going, well, obviously, and you're going first.
I'll go first.
Just before we do that, though, can we explain to the listeners and me who Joy V. Behar is?
So she's the host of The View. So that's the clip you just heard. They're on The View, the US talk show in the middle of the day, talking about the US midterms.
Good context.
Thank you.
Okay, you go first.
Okay, so I'm going to name out a few names here, and you guys are going to tell me what you think when you hear it.
Okay.
All right, Donald Trump, George Washington.
Oh, sorry, I thought we...
No, one by one. It's not a Rorschach test.
Okay.
Just wait till the end. Donald Trump, George Washington, Ben Franklin, James Madison. What am I seeing? I'm seeing white men.
Yeah.
And as we discussed in the show earlier, white men will stick together no matter what. You know, we've gone into something similar to that.
Probably.
But they're all white men. White men stick together. White men are just trying to oppress people.
Yeah.
That's the one thing I've learned from these midterm elections. So it only makes sense that they're all going to stick up for each other. And, you know, they might not have known it at the time, but I definitely think when they were deciding what was Pennsylvania and what was New York and what was New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
that they were thinking ahead to 2018 midterm elections.
Yeah.
Just prove me wrong.
Okay, well, that's thank you for your talk, James. Obviously, that's stupid. That's stupid, or as Americans would say, that's stupid.
Wow. Because they just called George Washington
stupid. The states of America became states in a variety of ways, and obviously that's crazy that you would think forward to the 2018 midterm elections when doing the borders of various states. And I don't want to get personal, but the reason you think that's true is because you're stupid as well.
Wow. Is that what...
That's, and oh, yeah? you would think something
you
like
have
that.
Smaller hands than I do, so yeah. Therefore,
mate, Donald Trump has small hands and he's the most powerful man in the world.
Oh, so you're saying that Donald Trump is powerful and worthy of respect and therefore he did gerrymander?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I think he's just talking himself in circles there.
Well,
all
anyway.
Right, Nina, who won? Who gets a Q&A clap?
Well,
that's
yes.
Can I just okay? Thank you.
You okay?
Well, you lost the argument anyway.
Yeah,
you lost it. When you said about the, you lost.
I gotta say, your point that I was stupid was very compelling.
Yeah. I like that one. And then when you're talking about the small hats, yeah, no, you just lost.
I thought
one.
That was off the record. Anyway, fine. Well, we'll keep it telling. I'll get you next week, you all spud.
All right, that's it for the show this week. Thanks again to Tom Switzer and Simon Breeny. We're going to miss Simon a whole lot.
Yeah, no, it's been a pleasure, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. And thank you guys so much for listening out there. Once again, available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Podbean. Spotify. I said SoundCloud, it's not true anymore. Sorry about that.
Spotify.
Spotify, that's the one I wanted.
But tell your mates.
Tell your mates. If they're on Android phones, just get the Podbean app or Pocket Cast or anything. You can listen through that. You can also listen through the IPA website. Make sure you're telling people. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us that 5-star review. We crave it. We desperately desire it. And Nina, if people want to become members, we talked about Generation Liberty earlier in the show. Go back and listen to that if you missed it. And if you want to get involved, there's so many universities you can get involved with. And you can also get involved with the IPA in general by becoming a member. So how can people do that?
Well, just visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click the join button and choose your own type of membership, and starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. See you guys next week.
See
you,
everyone.